Welcome to the History Reviewed channel, where we analyze the lies and deceptions of history. I've been doing a ton of reading as I'm busy planning my videos and various things for my website. And sometimes, in fact quite a lot of times, while I'm doing it, I actually run into things that weren't really on my list of things to do. I had other things in mind and I was doing research for other things when I stumble on something that I think is really important. And so I thought I'd rather just do a video while everything is fresh in my memory. Also, in this video, I'm going to give you more of an overview of certain topics. There are things I'm summarizing and I'm giving you a high-level perspective on it. There's no need to do a deep dive at this point in time, but some of the topics raised in this video are things that we can return to look at more closely later. On the screen in front of you, you are looking at five incredible white men. Five truly awesome white men of recent centuries. And there may be faces that you are not familiar with. So let's go through them. Top left, as if he needs any introduction, Adolf Hitler, Emperor of Germany and the Third Reich less than 100 years ago. The only white man of modern times in the age of photography and video who was an emperor, because that is really what Adolf Hitler achieved. And in that photo there, you're actually looking at the Third Reich, and take a look in the distant background, you're seeing that Roman eagle there in the background, and Hitler's doing his Roman salute. The Romans are a very important topic. But then there's the man on the top right. And that man is someone that Germans will be very familiar with, but lots of the Anglos and others won't really know much about him, if anything. And he is Frederick the Great. Now, Hitler had various heroes. And having heroes is very important. You need somebody that you can look up to, somebody that you can study and learn from. It's very important for boys and it's very important for girls. So Hitler's greatest hero was that guy on the far right there, on the top right, Frederick the Great. And you're going to learn a little bit in this video about how awesome Frederick the Great is. Now, Frederick the Great is really the man who is the beginning of Germany. Germany as we know it today comes from Prussia, and that man that you see there, Frederick the Great, he was the man who put Prussia on the map as a major player in Europe. Until Frederick the Great, Prussia was a minor little power, but Frederick the Great did things that were insanely incredible. Frederick the Great is also the hero, or one of the heroes, of Napoleon. And there's even a quote from Napoleon where Napoleon says that there are things that Frederick the Great did that not even he, Napoleon, would dare to do. Frederick the Great was a king, but what a king. Frederick the Great is probably one of the finest white kings who ever lived in history. One of the best quotes from an American military historian from more than 100 years ago regarding Frederick the Great was this comment: that Frederick the Great was every inch a king. And when you know something about Frederick the Great, you'll understand why. But in the top center, I put a quote from Frederick the Great. And the quote is this: "Great things are achieved only when we take great risks." And let me tell you, Frederick the Great took risks like you cannot believe. No man lived more on the edge than Frederick the Great. In fact, of all these awesome white men that you see on the screen in front of you, nobody lived on the edge like Frederick the Great, not even Hitler himself. Now, you may be wondering, who are these guys on the bottom? And some of you might not know who these gentlemen are, but you are looking at another three awesome Germans. So you're not only looking at incredible white men, you are looking at incredible white German men on this screen. So let's go from left to right. On the left is Field Marshal von Manstein. Then in the center is Heinz Guderian. He was a general. And then there may be a face that you've never seen before. The guy on the far right bottom is Erhard Raus. He is described as being a Nazi general, but in reality, he wasn't the same rank as Guderian or von Manstein. Of the three there, in terms of rank, Manstein is the highest rank, Guderian is the next highest, and then Erhard Raus. But Guderian in the center also had a very unique position later in the war, and that is inspector of motorized troops or inspector general of armored troops. It was a unique position created only for him. And just for the record, because the Jews write so much crap about history, I also just want to mention that of these three men, it was Manstein is the only one who was charged at Nuremberg, and he was convicted of war crimes and sentenced to 18 years imprisonment. And later they managed to get his sentence down, but Manstein spent 4 years in jail for apparent war crimes. Among the things that Manstein was accused of was that he'd been killing Jews. The reality is that all these officers were given orders by the German high command or directly from Hitler, and they did what they had to do. In the case of Manstein, he was merely executing partisans and all kinds of scum who were breaking the rules of war, and everybody that he had executed was executed for the right and proper reasons. We will actually get back to Manstein and some of the hard decisions he had to make, because once you understand it, you'll see that all this talk about the German army being a bunch of scum and that they were committing all kinds of war crimes, it's all bollocks. And if you really understand the discipline of the German army, you will be truly amazed. You'll be astounded, and we'll return to that with Manstein. The so-called partisans are really guerrillas and terrorists who are waging war behind enemy lines, and it included Jews. And rest assured, everybody who was executed was executed for a very good reason. In European warfare, fighting behind enemy lines automatically results in the death penalty, and the Allies also carried these things out. They also executed Germans and others who were caught behind their lines. Now, the reason we're looking at all these military men is because the topic is about things that went wrong in World War II for the Germans. You will have noticed that when I did videos comparing Hitler and Napoleon, that I made it clear that while Hitler was a great leader and Hitler was responsible for so many things that were good and awesome, the fact is that he and Napoleon are different in the sense that Napoleon was a true military man, a true warrior. Hitler was the corporal who became the leader of Germany, and Hitler was absolutely brilliant. And Hitler really had a genius that was functioning on multiple wide ranges of subjects. So his tremendously broad knowledge allowed him to overcome so many things. But what we're going to discuss in this video is that when it came to military stuff, there was a place where Hitler was not quite equal to the greatest military minds. And Hitler fell short on certain things. It's quite a complicated discussion, this. It's not totally that Hitler lacked knowledge. It was also that Hitler had other knowledge that clashes with military knowledge. There are quite a few issues at stake here, which I'm going to try to cover. And then you're going to see how this ties back to Frederick the Great. Because Hitler was convinced he was doing things correctly in the same way that Frederick the Great was doing certain things. But you'll see where the shortfall comes in. It's on a very specific topic. In the early days of the Nazis, Hitler created the SA, and the leader of the SA was very radical. Hitler himself is also radical. He's also very radical. And whites should be radical. We should all be radical. But there was a particular problem. The head of the SA was thinking that the Nazis should kill all the generals and senior military officers. This would be almost like what the Jewish Bolsheviks did in Russia. They went and slaughtered the entire officer class, but they did more. They killed anybody who had any brains. They were killing intellectuals, they were killing teachers, but the big damage to Russia was the slaughter of all their top military officers and the whole military officer class. Rome wanted to do something like that, perhaps not on such a scale, but he wanted to kill the officer class. Hitler became aware of this, and Hitler actually ended up killing certain people in the SA in order to stop them killing the generals. So Hitler actually saved the lives of the generals from these more radical guys in the SA. Hitler clearly realized that destroying the officer class was not going to be good for Germany. But he did have stress with the officer class, especially these guys who come from a Prussian background. And the officer class, being of Prussian background, that takes us back to Frederick the Great a bit. The only officer on here who isn't actually of that class is the guy in the bottom right. Erod Raus. Out of these five guys that you see here on the screen, Hitler on the top left and Erod Raus on the bottom right are the only two Austrians, or let's say Austrian Germans. Erod Raus was one of about three Austrians who reached, let's say, the rank of general in the Wehrmacht. Now, Hitler had a concern that these German military officers, who themselves represented a kind of upper class, a kind of military upper class, he was concerned that they were working against him, and he didn't trust them. Now, this becomes a very complex topic, and there are things that I just don't know, and I haven't been able to reach conclusions on. But Hitler did not trust the entire officer class of the German army. The fact that Hitler was the Chancellor and that Hitler had access to spies, etc., Hitler unquestionably knew many things that we would not know. So it's very possible that Hitler knew of rumors, of plots, of particular people and what they said about him, etc., and that it irritated him and angered him, and that as the war continued, that this may have become worse. One of the things I've come across, which I can't really be certain of, is that I have picked up that there was a guy, Bormann, and Bormann married Hitler's sister. And because he was now family of Hitler, I've come across many mentions that Bormann may have poisoned Hitler against certain people. I don't know enough, but I think Bormann needs to be added into the equation here. That maybe someone like Bormann was also adding to Hitler's distrust and paranoia. Possibly. There seem to be quite a lot of people high up in the Nazi party and in the German government who really did not like this Bormann character. And they regarded him as a snake, but a snake with access to Hitler. The bottom line is that as the war continued, at some point there was an ever-growing schism between Hitler and the generals, like these guys below. But Hitler had real problems with all the senior military officers, and he grew to have quite a contempt for them. Now, where the real problems begin are in the massive war in Russia, in the Soviet Union. The issue is not that the Soviet Union is so powerful, the Jewish Soviet Union is so powerful that Germany can't defeat it. The real problem is that America, especially, is pumping vast amounts of military equipment and things into the Soviet Union. America is making the Soviet Union much stronger than it is. Britain is also helping, but it's really America that's pumping up the Soviet Union and making it many, many times stronger than it would otherwise have been. So if you look at Hitler's campaigns, let's say his campaigns in Poland, for example, you won't find that there is any real dispute about the battle plan. Poland is easier to conquer than France or Russia. But when it comes to the tough ones, like the French and the Russians, then the whole military planning thing becomes much trickier. The German High Command basically came up with a plan to fight France, but the plan was almost, but not quite, the same as what they had done in World War One. It had a lot of those elements in it. And I have done a video where I've mentioned that these two guys on the bottom center and left, Manstein and Guderian, were the key guys in coming up with a better plan to knock out the French. It was really Manstein who came up with the plan. He ran it by Guderian because Guderian was the specialist in tanks, and Manstein and Guderian thought this plan could work. And by various means, Hitler got to hear of it, and Hitler then looked into it and he liked it a lot. But Hitler, Manstein, and Guderian were the only guys who even truly believed in the plan. So, when it came to the invasion of France, those three men agreed totally on a plan, but meanwhile, the rest of the German high command did not believe in the plan. However, the plan worked like a bomb. And to the utter amazement and horror of the British and Americans and Jews, the Germans knocked out the French in 40 days. So when Manstein, Guderian, and Hitler all could agree on a plan, then you have to know the plan was good. And it stunned the world. However, where things start changing is when the Germans go into the Soviet Union in a preemptive strike against the Soviets because the Jewish Bolsheviks have already gathered armies to come and invade Hitler. That is a topic I'll get to. It's coming. It's something that I partly completed that I will complete. So Hitler went and popped the Soviets about 2 weeks before they were gonna pop the Germans. And guys like Guderian played a big role in the planning and the fighting in Russia. Manstein also moved to the Eastern Front, as did Raus. So they got off to a great start and they were just smacking the living shit out of these Soviets. But then the tensions started, and it had to do with changes to the battle plan. The Soviet Union is so big, and they have various goals initially, but then as the months go by, Hitler tells them that they need to change their priorities, and he starts making other moves. Léon de Grelle, who I have a lot of respect for, General Léon de Grelle, the Belgian, he comes out in total support of Hitler. I really like de Grelle, and I still want to do some videos about de Grelle. De Grelle is awesome, but de Grelle was not a proper warrior like these guys on the bottom. The same kind of critique that I could make regarding Hitler and Napoleon, I can make regarding de Grelle. De Grelle was a politician, whereas these other guys are military professionals. Manstein and Guderian, for example, fought in World War One as officers. Their career was a military career, just like Napoleon's career was a military career. So de Grelle makes certain arguments. He says that certain things were Hitler's ideas and that Hitler did show great military flair. And he even defends things like changes of the plan. So there are fuzzy areas where it's hard to say who's right or wrong. For example, de Grelle says things like the fact that Hitler changed the goals and sent the Wehrmacht to go and get Kiev. That this was a very brilliant move because there was a huge industrial sector there, and military stuff was being produced there, and to not go after Kiev immediately was to leave certain military production in the hands of the Soviets. So he then says it was right to go and fight in Kiev and seize Kiev first before you go somewhere else. But even on that topic, that is where I'm going to explain to you why de Grelle is wrong and why Hitler was wrong. But at that point in time in the war, it maybe didn't matter that much. But later on, there are things that Hitler does that really burns the Germans. And that's what I'm going to discuss here and show you. One of the first times where there is stress is also the fact that the German army doesn't get to Moscow in the first winter. I don't think that was such a critical issue, but I will explain things that are critical issues. Where the real stress starts is with Stalingrad and the loss of the German 6th Army at Stalingrad. That's where the real stress starts. That's early in 1943. And it is then that things start going wrong for the Germans. From that time onwards, things just get worse and worse for the Germans. Keep in mind that 90% of the German army is fighting against the Soviet Union because America and Britain have helped to build up the Soviet Union into becoming the greatest enemy of the Germans. Between the Jews and the Americans militarily and in business and the British, they've built up Germany's greatest enemy. And they've armed that enemy physically. That enemy's got factories, has got technology. There are even times when large amounts of military equipment is physically moved from America to Russia. When I look at the kinds of things that Hitler was talking about and that were bothering him, it becomes evident that Hitler sees two things that are important to him. The one is land, territory. Hitler becomes obsessed with territory. He wants territory, and once he's got it, he doesn't want to give it up. Then within the territory, he is looking at specific pieces of territory that have got mineral value, things like oil and mines. And when they enter this phase where things are going wrong and the German army is starting to retreat, Hitler's constantly focusing on pieces of territory that he wants to keep. And Hitler then issues this fight to the last man, last round kind of order. And from that time onwards, right until the end of the war, he gets so angry that generals are retreating, that armies are retreating. And he keeps telling them, you must fight and you mustn't retreat. You must not retreat. And it drives Hitler crazy. Because Hitler sees that if they lose territory, they are losing valuable resources and the economy is going to go down, and he doesn't want that to happen. So in a nutshell, Hitler is making a decision that territory and economic objectives are more important than anything else. Hitler is right in many ways. He's totally correct. In fact, if you look at the lessons of history of great powers like Russia, America, the Spanish Empire, etc., then those lessons become very clear that Having a big physical country, having lots of access to minerals, etc., that this makes you very powerful, and that this ultimately, over centuries, that this stuff causes one nation to defeat another one. That having those things is a critical central resource. So, from that sort of high level strategic perspective, Hitler is right. However, we're in a war, and in wartime, there are some things that are different. So, what really happens is the stresses come between Hitler and the generals, and the arguments are about the following things. The generals keep asking Hitler for the chance to retreat. And right from the beginning, for example, in the battle at Moscow in the first winter, the German army starts collapsing, and the generals are begging Hitler to retreat, and Hitler refuses. And in that winter, they actually do some very brilliant stuff in order to survive. It's actually amazing. And again, a topic for another day. And Leon de Grel comes out and he says that Hitler was right there and that it was the correct thing to do. And amazingly, the German army did survive. With losses, but they did survive. And what Hitler is really pushing at is Hitler is quite obsessed with the notion that if you allow a general a chance to retreat, or you want to give people an excuse not to fight, then they'll take it. And he is right. Warfare is very hard. And what makes warfare really nasty is that men have to be pushed. Commanders have to demand all kinds of nasty things from their men. And the whole setup of warfare and the military is that men are pushed to their limits. So there are many times when men don't want to be pushed, but they are pushed, and they can be pushed to such a degree that they can even die. So warfare is different to normal life because there are tremendous stresses that are at work here. And speaking from his World War I experience, Hitler feels that if you let people have a chance to retreat, they will. And he gets very irritated by this. Now, in 1941, it doesn't matter so much, but by the time the Soviets have been built up and pumped up with extra resources and weapons and factories and things, by 1943, it's now getting to be a real tough game. The German army now is facing Soviet armies that are outnumbering them. They've got more equipment, they've got more troops, they've got vast resources. So when you get to things like Stalingrad and the things that happen after Stalingrad, when the front collapses for a time, when you get to that situation, Hitler is now finding that he's getting more and more and more requests from generals to retreat. And it's pissing him off. So not only does Hitler not want to retreat, but Hitler feels that they should still be attacking. So another place where Hitler and the generals start differing is with regard to the Battle of Kursk, the Kursk Offensive, which is lied about as being the greatest tank battle in history. Hitler's looking at the map, and he sees that the Russians have got what's known as a salient. They've cut their way partly into the German lines, and Hitler looks at it and he's convinced that the German army can encircle them and cut them up and surround them and defeat them. When he runs this by von Manstein, and I can't offhand remember whether he ran it by Guderian and what Guderian said, but I think von Manstein and Guderian and others spoke out quite firmly against the Kursk offensive. I'm quite sure that Manstein definitely did. What they pointed out was that the Soviets had by then become aware of these encircling tactics, and they themselves had made preparation and built defenses in case the Germans come to encircle them. And they were not in favor of the Kursk offensive. However, Hitler decided it must be done. They must try that offensive in that summer, and he gave the order, and the German army went and fought there. Manstein actually commanded the southern pincer, and it was actually Manstein who cut the deepest into the Russian lines. But eventually the Germans had to give up on Kursk, and they had quite a lot of losses there. The losses were not a total disaster, but they lost men and weapons that they could rather have kept. But Kursk is an example of an offensive where Hitler was pushing for it, even though these guys, who in the past he had agreed with and they'd seen eye to eye, now they don't see eye to eye. And he doesn't trust their judgment either. When they tell him that it's better to not do an offensive in that summer of 43, he doesn't listen to them. And he pushes for the offensive. And then they suffer the subsequent losses. And from 1943 onwards, 44, 45, as time goes by, the schism between Hitler and the generals just gets worse and worse and worse and worse. And Hitler is convinced that the generals are sabotaging him. And he starts firing them. And he fires many officers, many generals. But with regard to the three on the screen there, the first guy that he fires is Guderian, the guy in the center. He's already fired Guderian earlier in the war because Guderian commanded an army and Guderian retreated. Hitler was absolutely infuriated that Guderian retreated because it left the armies to his left and his right to take a lot of additional strain because of the Soviets. So Guderian was fired outright for retreating. And I think Guderian was out of the military for 14 months. So this was among the first earliest firings. In the meantime, Manstein is continuing, and Manstein gets promoted eventually to field marshal. And Manstein pulls off lots and lots of feats on a big scale. Manstein even tries to save the troops in Stalingrad. In fact, Erhard Raus, the guy on the far right, on many occasions he actually falls under von Manstein. On many occasions, in many military operations, he's actually reporting to Manstein. So Manstein and Raus, for example, are responsible for trying to save the troops in Stalingrad. But where Manstein delivers the last great victory of the German army is at a battle known as the Third Battle of Kharkov. In this particular battle, Manstein manages to convince Hitler to do what he is asking, which is to retreat. You see, what happens is that when Stalingrad is finally surrendered, Stalingrad has been responsible for sort of sucking in a lot of the troops on the Russian side into Stalingrad. And when Stalingrad falls, it frees vast numbers of Russian troops, actually. So suddenly, all those troops that were fighting the Sixth Army now are freed, and they're able to launch massive attacks on the Germans in the southern part of Russia. And this is where Manstein is in command. So when Manstein sees this situation developing, he goes to great lengths to talk to Hitler and to say to Hitler, listen, the whole front, the entire front is going to collapse. The Russians are coming in huge quantities, but I've got a plan. And Manstein comes up with a plan that requires that they retreat. But they don't retreat immediately. They let the Russians come, and as the Russians hit them, they slowly retreat backwards. And Manstein promises Hitler that if they can absorb these attacks for long enough and retreat slowly, that there will come a point where the Russians are going to be tired and short of fuel, etc., and then they can hit back. Hitler feels very uncomfortable over this plan. But at that point in time, Manstein has done so many things that are awesome that Hitler goes with it. But he's very uncomfortable. Hitler is very uncomfortable. He's getting very irritable, and Manstein has to reassure him and give him updates regularly. And exactly as Manstein explained to him, the time comes where they can go on a counterattack. And when they do, they smash the Russians. They crush those armies and they break them. And he delivers Germany's last great victory of World War II. So he delivers on his promise, and you would think that Hitler will be happy. But ironically, it's not long thereafter that Hitler fires Manstein. He doesn't fire Manstein for losing. He doesn't fire Manstein for retreating. When he fires Manstein, he tells Manstein that he is not going to need him anymore because there aren't going to be big operations anymore. So the sad fact is that Manstein, when he's fired, he will never ever fight in the German army again. He's actually going to be out of the war until the very end. So the guy who's delivered the greatest strategic victories to Hitler is fired and he's no longer going to be used. Manstein himself keeps coming back to Hitler at every opportunity he gets, right into 1945. Every now and then he tries to get a chance to talk to Hitler and to offer his services to Hitler, and Hitler refuses right until the end. Manstein is loyal to Hitler all the way. He never conspires against Hitler, he never turns against Hitler, and right to the last year of the war, even to January 1945, Manstein is still coming to Hitler and saying, my services are here, if you give me a task, I will do it, etc. Hitler's not interested. It seems to me that at the time that Hitler fires Manstein, that it is from this time onwards that Hitler goes into what we could call World War One mode, where he says, no retreating, fight to the last man, last round, etc., etc. Interestingly enough, Round about this time is when Hitler decides to call Guderian back. Guderian's been out of the war for 14 months. Manstein's going to be out of the war for a year. So these two guys who are so brilliant, they physically don't even function at critical times when they are needed, when they could make a difference. Guderian is brought back and he gets given a special position, which I've mentioned as the Inspector General of Motorized Troops. It is actually a step up for him, and it gives him the ability to deal with the armor. He gets to deal with the tanks and tank development. So this is one of the better moves that Hitler makes when he brings Guderian back, and Guderian is there right until the last day of the war as this inspector general, and he also has direct access to Hitler, and he plays a role, a critical role, in the development of weapons. So in that sense, after 14 months of being out, Guderian's back, and Guderian is able to contribute to the end of the war. Erhard Rauss, he's in the war all the way until about March 1945, until about 2 months or so before the end of the war. Rauss pulls off many feats. He's of a lower level than Manstein and Guderian, but Rauss pulls off insane feats of his own, incredible feats. He's even winning battles in 1945. In 1945, can you believe, Erhard Rauss is winning battles. In some cases, his armor is outnumbered 20 to 1. And he's winning. He's beating the enemy. But he also is asking for the chance to retreat. Guderian, in his memoirs, he goes into great detail about the need to retreat and get what's called reserves, which I'm going to go into. Guderian writes a lot about it, and it drives him crazy. Even this real hardcore determined Austrian German, Rauss, even he is also begging for the opportunity. And he's not the only one. There are lots of generals who are asking Hitler, please, let us retreat and form reserves. And can you believe that despite him winning battles and surviving in incredible bad situations in 1945, that Hitler meets with Rauss and fires him as well? So Hitler is firing guys who have shown that they know what they're doing, they've delivered to Hitler in a big way, and he's firing them, man. He's not listening to them. Hitler alone is arguing against all of his generals and he's overriding all of them, no matter how good they are, no matter their proven track record. And there are many others that he fires and gets rid of. And at all times, the argument is over territory versus retreating. One senior Nazi leader that I've not really looked at much is Heinrich Himmler. Himmler was in charge of the SS. And I just want to tell you about an interesting discussion and series of events that took place between this guy Rauss and Heinrich Himmler. By 1945, Rauss is in charge of an SS Panzer army. And he has direct access to Heinrich Himmler. When it comes to Nazis of high intellect, we've got Hitler at the top with a very broad spectrum of knowledge. And in certain areas, Hitler is almost unmatched. like when it comes to science and engineering and quite a lot of other things. He's really got a very broad mind. But another guy that I have tremendous respect for is Goebbels. Goebbels is seriously clever as well. But when it comes to Heinrich Himmler, he's more of an unknown quantity. And I've not really had a chance or taken the time to really dig into Heinrich Himmler. But I came across a very interesting set of discussions that took place between Erhard Rauss and Heinrich Himmler. Rauss was reporting to Himmler about the battles he was fighting inside Germany in 1945. Then, at a point, he goes to meet Himmler face to face, and they actually have a dinner. And then, after the dinner, he and Himmler are together, and he reports on what he's been doing and on the fighting. And he ends up spending 4.5 hours talking to Himmler, explaining to him what's been going on in his particular area. And at a point, Erhard Rauss decides to say something to Himmler that he thinks could get him not only fired, but even executed. At a point, Rauss says to Himmler that he thinks they are fighting and doing the wrong things, that they really need to be able to retreat and to form reserves. And he goes and he talks at great length. And in his memoirs, he writes and says that he's expecting to be arrested immediately, or fired, or even executed for what he's saying to Himmler. So he speaks his mind to Himmler, and Himmler says to him, "Yeah, say what's on your mind." And he comes out and he speaks his mind. And when he's finished, he's thinking that this is it, this is the end of his career or the end of his life. And Himmler actually leans forward and says to him, "I agree totally with every word that you've spoken." Then Himmler explains that he's been trying to tell the same thing to Hitler, and that Hitler is disregarding him as well. Then what Himmler suggests is that Rauss go and meet Hitler directly. And Himmler picks up the phone and phones Hitler immediately and tells him, "Listen, you've got to speak to this general. I'm going to send him to you." And Hitler says, "Fine, send him tomorrow and I'll meet with him." There are quite a few other things that Erhard Rauss goes into that shows that Himmler is on his side. Himmler's not just talking, he genuinely is on this guy's side and he genuinely agrees with what these generals are saying. So Rauss goes to see Hitler and he tells Hitler the story of his battles that he's just fought against tremendous odds, insane odds, and how they've managed to hold the line. He tells the same stuff to Hitler that he told to Himmler, and Himmler was impressed as hell. Hitler's actually not very friendly, and can you believe that when he's finished telling his story to Hitler, his amazing story, that Hitler actually fires him. So the only guy who's left right until the end is Guderian, and he argues with Hitler right to the end, but Hitler doesn't listen to him either. Hitler is absolutely certain that he's right. And make no mistake that Hitler believes he's right, but he isn't. So let me try to explain what these generals are arguing about and what their real point is. The problem is that the Germans are very outnumbered by now, and the Soviets have got vast armies not only vast armies, but modern equipment. They've got all the latest stuff. They've got access to equipment that the Germans don't have. And by now, the Germans have also had a lot of losses. So the Germans are struggling to hold these hordes back. And what these generals are trying to do, let me explain what these generals are trying to do, because we're still going to get to Frederick the Great. In a nutshell, these generals have got such few resources in terms of men and equipment that what they are trying to do, it gets very complicated, but in a nutshell, what they're trying to do is they are trying to make it so that their armies don't collapse. Because when an army collapses, the men just start running away. They start running away, things just fall apart, and then everything is gone. So you can't have your men suddenly breaking and running, because that is what happens in actual warfare. That the time comes when things go very wrong, that men just can't take it anymore. And whether they are modern men or ancient white men, they run for their lives. They get to that point where they break and they run. And so what these generals are trying to do is they're trying to avoid a chaotic situation like that. Because men can panic, and no matter how tough you are, you can get to the point where you will panic. And when men panic, the panic can spread like wildfire. And it can start with just a couple of guys panicking, and then eventually, freaking the whole army is busy running away. These things happen all the time in military history. So what these generals are trying to do is they are trying to get their men to retreat so that they can build defensive positions, so that they can dig trenches and find places where they can defend. So that's the one thing, is they're trying to get their men into better positions where they can defend from. And then the next thing is they're also trying to pull men out of the front line to form what they call reserves, so that they can take those men and use them for emergency situations in parts of the line where the line is about to collapse, so that they send reinforcements where reinforcements are needed. These guys actually are even more sophisticated than that, much more sophisticated. They even have multiple lines of defenses. Raus, for example, created lines where there are troops in the front line, but then they quickly withdraw them when the Russians come, and the Russians actually fire at empty lines, and the men have already moved to the next line. And then when the Russians think that they have broken through the first line and they move forward, they find themselves meeting the real Germans who really hit them, and the Russians run away. These guys do very, very sophisticated stuff. It's so sophisticated, so clever, so unique. These guys are very sharp. These generals are really sharp. These are no fools. And so all that they're asking for is they're asking for flexibility. But in military terms, the concept is the following. In military terms, the concept is that you trade space for time. You see, generals have to make harder decisions than anybody else. Generals are used to making really nasty, nasty decisions because they are operating on the edge of what is humanly possible. So these generals are used to the concept that an army can collapse, but what you do is you need to trade space for time. You rather gather your troops together, they run away, things have fallen apart, but you gather them together further in the rear, and that buys you time. You've given up land, but you've bought yourself time. And the other thing that is just as important, if not more important, is that you trade space for the lives of your soldiers. I remember my brother saying to me in Rhodesia, run away and live to fight another day. And he said it as a joke. But there is logic in that. It is not an excuse to run away, but what the generals are trying to do is they are trying to pull their troops out of situations where their troops are too overwhelmed. They've got too many enemies coming at them, and they're trying to pull them back, reform units, build up their numbers, and then be able to fight them and have more troops to fight with. Because as the battles are raging, certain units are going to be overwhelmed and vastly outnumbered. So the goal is to try and pull them away rather than letting them get killed. You see, it ultimately boils down to a problem, a ratio problem. Some troops can fight and be outnumbered 2-1 or 5-1, and the going is still good. They are capable of handling that. But others may find themselves in a situation where they're outnumbered 10-1, 20-1. And at some point, being too overwhelmed can cause you to be totally wiped out. So all that these guys are trying to do is they're trying to save on this ratio issue. They don't want guys to die needlessly. Rather than leaving, let's say, 1,000 men who are outnumbered and are being attacked by 20,000, it is better to rather take those 1,000 and withdraw them, reinforce them, add in new troops, and get them into a position where they can fight again and they are in a better state. And that's all that these generals are trying to do. But Hitler is so obsessed with keeping territory and the value of territory, and also that he believes that these guys are just looking for reasons to retreat, when in fact that is not the case. These generals are not cowards and they're not losers, but they do know how far they can push their men. And they are telling Hitler that they really need to pull their guys back. So the concept here is trading space, land, for A, time, and B, save the lives of your men. And this is where they are clashing with Hitler. Hitler is saying that the land is more important than the time or the lives of the men. And I don't think that Hitler even truly grasped that by doing this, he's saving his troops' lives. I want to show you a very informative chart. I want to look really closely at this chart because when you understand this chart, you'll see some very, very important information that pertains to World War II and the Germans. And it also pertains to all wars, really. But you need to understand this, because once you grasp this, then you will really start grasping warfare. So what this chart is it is a chart showing, and this seems to be the start of each year, start of 1939 to 1940 to 1944, to the start of 1945. We don't see the 5 months in 1945, the last 5 months of World War II for the Germans. But even so, this thing shows us a ton of very important information. Now, this is actually a manpower chart. So it's showing the manpower of Germany as the years go by, but it's got different charts stacked on top of each other, which make this somewhat difficult to grasp. It's useful, very useful, but there are problems as well. So, for example, here you can see the number of male civilians. The male civilians go down as the war continues. And that is no doubt because male civilians are being put in the army. And then there is this area, which is others. It's female civilians and foreign workers, including probably prisoners of war, etc. But what we really want to look at is this thing of armed forces. But now what they've done is the armed forces is a chart stacked on top of this other chart. So it's a chart that is not actually level because it's based on the things below. But even so, we'll be able to get some information out of it. And it's this chart in particular that I want to focus on. But I want you to see all these other things so that you know where this comes from. So I'm doing a bit of editing and I'm cutting parts out of this thing. So this is the chunk that I'm cutting out, but I also want to see the years so that we can look at it more closely by year. So here it is. This is the best that I can do to try and get it close to the year. And so the thing that you need to grasp here is that this is not flat. So this entire area that is shaded in this color, this is the total size of the German army. So you can get a rough idea that the German army starts out quite small, probably something like this, probably something like that here, and then it grows. And then by 1940, when they fight in France, then that is the size of it here. But what I want to show you is the relationship between the armed forces that are active and the armed forces that are killed. So you will notice that from 1939, the whole of 1939 and the whole of 1940, that the German army's actual losses are minuscule. They fought in Poland and crushed the Poles. That's round about here, September, I think. Then they fought the war against the British and the French over here, the 40 days in May. They've fought and won two entire campaigns, and there's hardly any losses. On this chart, you can't see the losses. That's how few there are. There are so few losses that you don't even notice it. 2 years of World War II have gone by, and there's virtually no losses. It is only here in 1941, at the end of 1940, that you start to see a little bit of losses. And the Germans are fighting in North Africa. They are starting to fight in other places, all across Europe, etc. And they're doing all those things before they're even starting Operation Barbarossa. So the Germans have fought like crazy. They've fought in Africa, they've fought in Norway, they've fought in Greece, and they've fought in France. They've beaten the British, they've beaten the French, they've beaten the Poles, and they've hardly lost any soldiers. And then starts Operation Barbarossa. And then from there onwards, you start seeing the actual casualties coming. And the casualties increase with time as the fighting gets harder and harder. But by 1943, which is when we've lost in Stalingrad, by 1943, you will start seeing the casualties increasing. By this time, they've fought for a year, more than a year. In Russia, on top of all the other campaigns that they are fighting. So by the middle of 1943, they are starting to get losses, but it's nothing compared to what it's going to be. It is only now from the time of the end of Stalingrad that the losses start piling up. And then we've got 1944, which is D-Day. Here in the middle of 44, we've got D-Day. So that is when the British and the American backstabbers invade and smack the Germans from the rear, so to speak. So now the Germans are fighting a war on two fronts. And as time goes by, you see these casualties increasing. And you can kind of extrapolate this, that it goes on, and the German army, we don't know exactly what happens here. It could get even worse here. From the reading I've done, these numbers would get even worse. The German army will get a lot smaller, and the casualties will grow. But I wanted to show you this, because this is very important. It shows you that at the start of the war, when they were fighting well-organized campaigns, their losses were virtually none. Their losses were virtually nothing compared to the size of their army. Their army grew to its maximum size by the early part of 43, and even then the losses weren't that bad. And we're talking, this is probably at the time of the loss of Stalingrad. And then in 43 we've still got the attacks, the tank battles at Kursk. The really important thing I want to show you is that we've gone from virtually no losses for 2 years to 2 years where there are losses, but they're not that bad. It's only in the final 2 years. In fact, the greatest number of losses start here from after Stalingrad. Even at Stalingrad, it's not that bad. The real losses, the time when it really starts getting crazy, is really from about the start of 44. And I'd like you to keep that in your head as we discuss the next section dealing with King Frederick the Great. Let's turn to Frederick the Great. Hitler's great hero was Frederick the Great. And Napoleon also looked tremendously in awe on Frederick the Great. But the difference between Hitler and Napoleon is that Napoleon was a warrior. He learned the art of war and he studied the art of war intensely. So Napoleon had also studied Alexander, Caesar, Hannibal, etc. I stand to be corrected, but it might be that Napoleon's hero that he had a bust of in his office might have been Hannibal. And don't be fooled by Jewish Hollywood black bullshit. Hannibal was a white man. But Hitler's great hero, right to the very end, was Frederick the Great. The truth of the matter is that Hitler wanted to be a hero. I've read about various things Hitler said, and there is no question in my mind that Hitler wanted to be a hero. He set out to do his utmost for Germany, and he did the best he could with what he had. Ignore all the crap that the Jews and the British and the Americans have to say about Hitler. Hitler was simply a guy who set out to do his utmost for his country and his people. That was what he set out to do, and he did it to the best of his ability. And like all heroes, he has his flaws. But what often happens when you are truly, truly great, which is what Hitler was, is that if you are truly great and you really press forward and you really achieve insane things, insanely awesome things, you get to a point where you reach the limits of your knowledge and you are moving in whole new territory. And then you start breaking down because you are in totally new territory. One could argue that the same thing is happening to the United States as a country, that America, after coming out and getting onto the world stage as a result of World Wars One and Two, that America itself has reached its limit and America is breaking down. This happens to everybody. When you end up in a situation that is greater than anything that you planned for, and then things start unraveling. You must never forget that for our time, that Hitler is a truly great man, he's achieved incredible things, and he's very, very relevant. He's the most modern of the great white men. Therefore, there is so much to learn from Hitler. Hitler has grown up in a modern state, in a modern European state, and he's achieved amazing things. He's done this in the time of so-called democracy, which even included the women's vote. Women voted for him as well. Anyway, Hitler's great hero is Frederick the Great, and we're going to look more closely at these Germans and Frederick the Great, because Frederick the Great is really the beginnings of modern Germany. So all the Germans look to Frederick the Great, and even the generals themselves, their great hero is Frederick the Great. And even the way that the German generals function is itself born out of the war that Frederick the Great waged. So I want to show you from the writings of various generals things that relate to Frederick the Great and where Hitler and the generals themselves were discussing Frederick the Great, where Frederick the Great starts coming up in conversations between Hitler and the generals in World War II. And the period that we're really interested in are those last 2.5 years of the war when everything starts going wrong. Near the end of the war, von Manstein is busy chatting to another one of his old friends, Bush, B-U-S-C-H, and in pops none other than Albert Speer. Albert Speer is a very important non-military German. He's actually a genius in his own right, but we're not going to discuss Albert Speer here. Anyway, Albert Speer also, by the way, was a huge fan of Hitler. So when Albert Speer pops in and joins Manstein and Bush and they chat, Speer tells them that he's been to see Hitler in his bunker, and he says that Hitler sits and behind him is a portrait of Frederick the Great. General Heinz Guderian in his own book also describes a similar type of thing. Listen to this. On the first occasion when he reported to Hitler, Krebs, K-R-E-B-S, was awarded the oak leaves to the Knight's Cross. This was an early indication of Bergdorf's influence. A few days later, Krebs and I went together to see Hitler. We arrived there ahead of time, and the other officers were not yet present. Hitler therefore invited us into his small private study. He pointed to Graf's portrait of Frederick the Great that hung above his desk and said, "When bad news threatens to crush my spirit, I derive fresh courage from the contemplation of this picture. Look at those strong blue eyes, that wide brow, what a head." We then discussed the great king's qualities as a statesman and a military leader. Hitler admired him more than he did any other man, and was only too eager to emulate him. Heinz Guderian is the general that quotes Frederick the Great the most often in his discussions with Hitler, and even with reference to himself. So I just want to go through some of the times when Frederick the Great comes up, because this will give you some insight into how Hitler's thinking and how these guys are arguing and talking. And then Frederick the Great comes up. Why? Because history relates to the present. And this is something that all whites need to understand, that just because things happened long ago does not mean it's irrelevant. There are many, many valuable lessons that you can draw from history. And if you know your history well, then you'll be able to pull out the relevant things that apply to now. But the history is also useful for the future. So you mustn't think that history is just the past and that we're just looking at the past for fun. No, the past relates to the present, relates to the future. It's all tied together, and you will see how the same things keep repeating themselves. There is lots to learn and to keep in mind from the biological experiences of our people. We are a biological entity, and we go through various cycles and phases. And studying history gives you a shortcut into a lot of knowledge. But I'm not here to discuss why history is so important. Maybe that's a video for another day. But the one area in Western civilization where history is studied the most intensely is actually in the military sphere. Because you'll be amazed that what happened 2,000 and more years ago still gives us lessons right up to today. So let's take a look at Heinz Guderian. The first time that Heinz Guderian has a clash with Hitler is in 1941 when the German army is at the gates of Moscow. When they get right to the suburbs of Moscow, there are some parts of the Wehrmacht that are actually managing to fight their way into Moscow. But the weather is really cold. In fact, it's insanely cold. It's something like minus 32 degrees. I must tell you, I can't even believe that these guys can try to fight in minus 32 degrees and that they are living outside in the open in minus 32 degrees. I must tell you, as a spoiled, weak white from Africa, I cannot even begin to imagine that. And what is happening is that Guderian wants to retreat, and so do others. And he sends messages to Hitler, and Hitler sends messages back to him, refusing to allow him to retreat. Eventually, what he does is he manages to travel back to Germany to speak directly to Hitler to tell him, listen, I really need to retreat. My guys are dying. They are dying from frostbite and the injuries of frostbite, etc. You've got to let us retreat. And the Russians are totally prepared for winter war. We are really in a bad situation. So then Hitler responds as follows. He says, do you think Frederick the Great's grenadiers were anxious to die? They wanted to live too, but the king was right in asking them to sacrifice themselves. I believe that I, too, am entitled to ask any German soldier to lay down his life. Then Guderian responds as follows. Every German soldier knows that in wartime he must risk his life for his country, and our soldiers have certainly proved up to now that they are prepared to do so. But such a sacrifice may only be asked of a man if the results to be obtained from it are worth having. The intentions I have heard expressed will lead to losses that are utterly disproportionate to the results that will be achieved. My soldiers will not have protection against the weather and the Russians until they reach the Susha-Oka line and the fortified positions that were built there in autumn. I beg you to remember that it is not the enemy who is causing us our bloody losses. We are suffering twice as many casualties from the cold as from the fire of the Russians. Any man who has seen the hospitals filled with frostbite cases must realize what that means. So Hitler responds, I know that you have not spared yourself and that you have spent a great deal of time with the troops. I grant you that. But you are seeing events at too close a range. You have been too deeply impressed by the suffering of the soldiers. You feel too much pity for them. You should stand back more. Believe me, things appear clearer when examined at a longer range. Guderian, naturally, it is my duty to lessen the suffering of my soldiers so far as that lies within my power. But it is hard when men have even now not yet received their winter clothing, and the greater part of the infantry are still going about in denim uniforms. Boots, vests, gloves, woolen helmets are either non-existent or else are hopelessly worn out. Hitler shouted, that is not true. The quartermaster general informed me that the winter clothing had been issued. Guderian, I dare say it has been issued, but it has never arrived. I have made it my business to find out what has happened to it. At present, it is in Warsaw Station, where it has been for several weeks, since it cannot be sent on owing to a lack of locomotives and obstructions to the lines. Our requests that it be forwarded in September and October were bluntly refused. Now it's too late. The Quartermaster General was sent for and had to admit that what I, Guderian, had said was correct. He goes on to say that Goebbels then had a public campaign to get clothes for the soldiers, and it was as a result of this conversation. The point here is the discussion between Guderian and Hitler about what is the right thing to do with the soldiers in this situation. And Hitler draws a parallel to a certain battle where Frederick the Great had told his grenadiers, I think he told his grenadiers that they must stand firm regardless of the fire against them. And they were standing there, and I think they were shot down one by one. It could be that that is what it's related to. But you must understand that there is something of a difference here, in that Frederick the Great was in the middle of a battle, and the firing was going on, and it's one of those European battles that is going very fast, where all the action is over in a couple of hours. So when you are in that situation, then the king or the general may make all kinds of decisions like that. It is in the heat of the battle, and those kinds of decisions have got relevance in that situation. But here in Moscow, it's not quite the same thing. Here the battle is going to rage on for weeks and months. And this point that Guderian is making, that the weather is harming and killing more troops than the Russians, that is a very important point. So let's look at another example. Remember, we are dealing with the final years of the war, mainly 44, 45. So things are going very wrong now. And here's another interesting passage from Guderian. He says, at Himmler's headquarters, the lack of organization soon began to make itself felt, in that its signals service failed to function. I told Hitler of this unsatisfactory state of affairs, but he took no interest in what I had to say, since he had just been informed by the chief of the Army Personnel Office of the measures taken by Kings Frederick William I and Frederick the Great. I think Frederick William I is the father of Frederick the Great. So these are the first two kings of Prussia. So just to repeat that, Hitler said he had been informed by the chief of the Army Personnel Office of the measures taken by Kings Frederick William I and Frederick the Great when faced with insubordination. General Bergdorf had consulted historical sources and now produced some crude examples of legal sentences delivered 200 years ago. When Hitler heard of them, he replied with deep satisfaction, and people are always imagining that I am brutal. It would be desirable if all the prominent men in Germany were to be informed of these sentences. So there is Hitler consulting history in order to see whether what he's doing is within the realms of the reality of the past. Would previous kings have done this? And it turns out that yes, they would have. So he doesn't have a problem with it. And I agree with that. I don't see any reason why we can't do things that we've done in the past. This is a topic I'll be returning to. Guderian does make some disparaging remarks about Hitler. He makes quite a bunch of disparaging remarks about Hitler, even in comparing him back to Bismarck and Frederick the Great. But I'm not going to go into those things. I will use this last quote from Guderian because it pertains to Frederick the Great, and in this case, he uses it for himself. So he also looks back on Frederick the Great. You see, when people do things, especially in the military world, you need to look back on the past heroes because they've gone and done things that are often impossible and in times of unbelievable danger. And you need to be able to draw lessons from them. It's very, very useful. And I must tell you, I think that the boys, if white boys were given the right education, white boys will be turned into awesome men. Hitler did this. Hitler did this for real. Hitler was definitely on the right track. But even men themselves who have to fight, who have to do things, and this doesn't just apply to military stuff. In science, for example, they look back on their greats and they are still busy dealing with problems that relate to things that great intellectuals did in the past. So we've got lots of people that we can draw on, and it's important to draw on our heroes because that is what helps guide people through life. Having the wrong heroes and wrong heroines results in new problems. That's another topic for another day. So anyway, here's what Guderian writes about Frederick the Great and how it applies to him. And he says, "At a difficult time, a prince of my royal family once sent me a small portrait of Frederick the Great, on which he had inscribed these words that the great king addressed to his friend Marcus d'Argens." Pardon my tremendously horrific French, but I'm just going to pronounce it in the English way. So apologies to anyone French. So these are the words that Frederick the Great addressed to his friend when his own defeat seemed imminent. And he said, "Nothing can alter my inner soul. I shall pursue my own straight course and shall do what I believe to be right and honorable." So Guderian says, "The little picture I have lost, but the king's words remain engraved on my memory and are for me a model. If, despite everything, I could not prevent the defeat of my country, I must ask my readers to believe that this was not for lack of a will to do so." And indeed, I will tell you that warts and all, if you look at what Guderian got up to, Guderian did the best that he could in the situation he was in, and he often argued with Hitler in the final parts of the war. He was arguing with Hitler a lot. The two of them had a lot of angry exchanges. In von Manstein's own biography, he only uses Frederick once. And he does it also at a time when he's busy arguing with Hitler. And so he sends a message to the German high command. So this is what he writes. And again here, you'll see names coming up. You'll see famous names coming up. And he writes, "This is what I wrote to General Zeitzler. If my misgivings about coming developments are disregarded, and if my intentions as a commander, which aim merely at removing difficulties for which I am not responsible, continue to be frustrated, I shall have no choice but to assume that the Führer has not the necessary confidence in this headquarters. I am far from believing myself infallible. Everyone makes mistakes, even great captains like Frederick and Napoleon. At the same time, I would point out that the 11th Army, that being his army, won the Crimean campaign under very difficult conditions, and that when faced with an almost hopeless situation at the end of last year, Southern Army Group still mastered it. If the Führer thinks he can find any Army Group commander or headquarters staff with better nerves than we had during the past winter, with more initiative than we showed in the Crimea, on the Donets, or at Kharkov, with greater powers of improvisation than were displayed by us in the Crimean or winter campaign, or with the ability to foresee the inevitable more clearly than we have done, I am fully prepared to hand over to them. As long as I remain at this post, however, I must have the chance to use my own head. So what he's saying there is that he's not saying that he's perfect, but he's been in really difficult positions and he's proven time and again what he can do. And all of those things that he talks about there are true. They are totally true. And Manstein is intensely creative. In fact, I want to read to you also a little bit what a modern general has written. A modern British general has written this about Manstein. And in here, you'll see Frederick the Great, Napoleon, etc. coming up. And you'll hear a name that you've not heard in a while. A name, Robert E. Lee, the great Confederate. So this is what a British general writes about Manstein. And he says, "As a highly professional and accomplished general staff officer and talented operational commander, there remains no contradiction here in the German army today. Manstein had the priceless ability to anticipate the actions of his opponent, to maneuver decisively and to foresee intuitively how best to exploit the resulting situation. An accomplished bridge and chess player, he was always thinking several moves ahead. As with fellow great captains such as Frederick the Great, Napoleon Bonaparte, or Robert E. Lee, he was not immune from mistake and misjudgment, but he was nevertheless remarkably and similarly successful for most of his operations and battles. Manstein and Guderian were good, successful, excellent commanders. They were among the top guys in the German army. And if we return to how it was in the beginning of the war, at the beginning of World War II, Hitler was listening to all these guys. He was listening to Manstein. He was listening to Guderian. He could see the logic of what they were saying, and he could agree with it. But now, more towards the end of the war, it's the total opposite. These same three white men, all of them brilliant, who had agreed and been able to agree on a plan and agreed that a plan would work and who made it work and who thereby achieved tremendous success early in the war, those same three men are now arguing with each other. But in actual fact, it is Manstein and Guderian who are arguing with Hitler. Manstein and Guderian are saying the same things to Hitler. And they're not alone. Others are saying it too. Raus is saying it. Many others are saying it. Even Himmler agrees with them that they are right and Hitler is wrong. And on this particular issue, this issue of the men must stand firm, they mustn't retreat, Hitler is wrong. And so is Leon de Grelle. De Grelle is really loyal to Hitler, but truly, he's wrong. The men are doing the maximum that they physically can, and you really cannot fault them. They are ending up in hospital. They are dying from the cold. They are really in a bad state. They really have every reason to want to retreat. Of course, you can also say that Hitler was failed by his own system, that he had sent them warm clothing and then, due to other stuff-ups that he was not aware of, due to other stuff-ups, that clothing did not get there. So you can't blame him. Somewhere in the system, something went wrong. The Germans are coming under ever more intensive pressure as the years go by, due to the Jews organizing more and more enemies and all their enemies coming at them more and more, until eventually the British and the Americans and all the other silly allies who are working for the Jews, until they all come and stab the Germans in the back. That backstab helps to finish off Germany. But the question is whether Germany should have just collapsed from 1943 onwards. Was it really inevitable that Germany would have collapsed after 6 years of war? Or could the Germans have lasted longer? In the case of Napoleon and the French ended up fighting everybody, including the British. And they also fought the British, the Russians, they fought everybody as well. Napoleon was in his own world war, make no mistake. The only difference between Hitler and Napoleon lies that in the time of Hitler, America is a very powerful country, and America is hugely powerful and is arming up massively the Soviet Union. And America is able to keep Britain going and even able to start fighting in Africa and Europe. So the big thing that Hitler faces that Napoleon didn't face is America, a whole other continent of whites who are able to come and stick their noses into European affairs. The other thing is that Hitler faces air power. Air power is something that doesn't exist in the time of Napoleon. So the speed of the military action in the time of Hitler is faster than in the time of Napoleon, to certain degrees. Not always, believe it or not, on the ground, Napoleon's armies can move as fast as some of those Panzer armies. But in other important aspects, there are things that work against Hitler. So, Napoleon and the French were able to survive 20 years before they collapsed. And even their collapse was not a collapse of physical impossibility. It was ultimately a thing that the people started growing tired of war. The French fought everybody and survived 20 years. And if they truly, truly had wanted to fight more, they could have fought more, but it would have included a civil war inside France, which Napoleon did not want to have. So if the French could have lasted 20 years, could the Germans have lasted longer than 6 years? And I must tell you, the more I read the final years of the war, especially 44 and even 45, where things are really, really bad, I must tell you, I think that the Germans could have lasted longer than 6 years. Manstein, in his memoirs, von Manstein, in his memoirs, actually says that even by the middle of 1943, even by the middle of 1943, and you can look at that chart and look at the state of the German army in the middle of 1943. At that point, they'd lost at Stalingrad. They had recovered in the Third Battle of Kharkov, but they lost in Kursk. Though it wasn't a big loss, it was very minor. But a lot of people like to cite Kursk and Stalingrad as the beginning of the end. Manstein said that even by the middle of 1943, there was absolutely no reason why the German army could not have fought to a stalemate and achieved a stalemate. And that's a very interesting thing. And Manstein is right. When an army is on the defensive, it has got a lot of advantages. Fighting on the defensive, an army does have a lot of advantages. And Manstein was certain that he could stabilize the Eastern Front. And there were lots of generals who liked Manstein and respected him tremendously. And the topic came up a number of times as to whether Hitler would put Manstein in charge of the entire Eastern Front. And I'm absolutely convinced that if Hitler, instead of him issuing his own orders, had merely taken Manstein and put him in charge of the entire Eastern Front, that you would have seen Germany fighting the Soviets to a standstill. They would have clobbered them no matter what they had. And I've seen some of the weaponry and technology that was starting to come out of Germany in 1944. On that chart where you see all those losses of the German army in 1944, one thing that happens in 1944 that's amazing is that right to the end of 1944, most of the military output is actually increasing. They're actually building more weapons than ever before. The only part of the German military that actually collapses in 1944 is the Luftwaffe. It's only the Luftwaffe that actually really goes backwards and suffers a true defeat. But the Wehrmacht is very much still active, and new weapons are coming online. Now, one of the things that I've been very fascinated with from a Rhodesian and South African and Portuguese in Africa perspective is I've been very, very interested in the problem of white men being outnumbered by the enemy. Not just physically outnumbered, but also facing enemy armies that have got more weapons. I would refer to it as the soldiers being overloaded. A question that I've had many, many times regarding Rhodesia, South Africa, white survival in Africa, is our problem of being outnumbered. We are vastly outnumbered. Can we survive despite being vastly outnumbered? And the best modern example of white men being outnumbered are the Germans on the Eastern Front. The Germans have got varying amounts by which they are outnumbered, but they are outnumbered often from 6 to 1 to even 20 to 1 on some occasions. And the one thing that I've concluded about soldiers being outnumbered, when you look at times when white men have been outnumbered and they succumb eventually, because Napoleon also was constantly facing huge armies, but the way that he managed to counter it was by quickly building up his militia, and he was constantly producing weapons. The thing that I've concluded is that white men can very often, if not most of the time, fight when they are outnumbered. But the real issue is how much you are outnumbered physically. There are two issues. The one is how many troops can the enemy amass? And the next thing is what quality of weapons can they give to their massed troops? So you're looking at two parameters. The one is how many troops, and then what quality of weapons are they getting? Because those two things combined will then give you, let's call it, the combat power that you are facing. In the case of the Germans on the Eastern Front, they're actually facing two kinds of outnumbering. The one is they are physically outnumbered, and the quality of the weapons of the Russians is improving all the time. So they are facing a real growing threat. And I've concluded that when white men are fighting in such a situation, but it's true for any army, it's true for any army that is defeated, that there is a point where you can handle being outnumbered, and it gets harder and harder and harder, and then there's a point where they start actually overwhelming you. And then the more they overwhelm you, the more losses you have. And the more they overwhelm you, the more losses you have in a shorter space of time. Go back and look at that chart again, and you will see that the German army starts breaking. The key to that chart is the rate at which they are suffering casualties and how their army starts declining. I'm certain that if you get to 1945, that you'll see that the army is collapsing even more and the casualties are going through the roof. What you're looking at, and it really starts happening in 1944, it's only by 1944 that you could say that the German army is really starting to collapse now. It is becoming overwhelmed. And you see the casualty figures go through the roof, the army becoming smaller, the army is starting to break down now. Those Germans, therefore, we could say that the German army, right up to the beginning of 1944, I would say that the German army, right up to the beginning of 1944, is still capable of fighting one hell of a battle, and that it's actually not yet defeated. It's starting to take heavy losses, but it's not defeated yet. By the start of 1944, it's still doing extremely well, despite the losses, but it becomes overloaded. Interestingly enough, despite the great D-Day invasion of the British, the Canadians and the Americans, despite D-Day, you can hardly notice that D-Day even makes much of a difference. Because the real thing that's hitting the Germans is the Soviet army. The Russians are winning World War II, but they're not doing it alone. They're doing it because of American technology and American weaponry. That's a whole other topic. I was actually looking at a really good presentation by a professor on this topic. This is very, very evident that the real victors were the Soviets. And it was because they were given everything by the Americans. But that's another topic. The scale of that will stagger you. So the one thing we can conclude is that the German army is definitely starting to get overloaded by 1944. But now, the other factor that's starting to play into this is Hitler's firing generals, and he also fires Manstein. Manstein actually commands the southern armies in Russia. Hitler fires him on the 30th of March 1945 and gives him a final award and gets rid of him. If you look at that chart, I ask myself whether the firing of Manstein actually is represented on that chart of the casualties. If you look a little way into 1944, you'll see that it's not the middle of 1944 at D-Day when the casualty rates of the German army goes up. It's actually before then. It's in the first quarter of 1944. And it actually corresponds with the time when Manstein was fired. And I actually wonder whether firing Manstein resulted in more casualties after Manstein. I'm actually wondering if you can actually see it. You'll see there's a slight bend that goes into a steeper slope, and that bend occurs in the first quarter of 1944. Hitler has fired his greatest general, and is that also causing a lot more losses? And then Hitler is continuing with this business of fight to the last man, last round. So the first issue is overloading of soldiers. White men can handle being outnumbered up to a point. That point needs to be determined, and it will vary from age to age, time to time. And it will vary according to the enemy that they are fighting against. So for us in Africa, for example, in my mind, I often sit and ask myself the question, at what point are we outnumbered? I'm quite certain that we are not as outnumbered as you think. But that's a separate topic. So depending on the quality, quantity and sophistication of the enemy that you are facing, and your own quantity, quality and sophistication, there will come a point where you will collapse when you face an enemy army. So all white men will have some limits somewhere. But what influences those limits is how you fight. Because depending on your tactics that you are using, your tactics and your strategies, you can handle even greater loads. In the case of Hitler's generals, what they are trying to point out is this, that when you have prepared defensive positions, in other words, trenches and stuff like that, trenches and bunkers and artillery positions, when you have time to prepare a defensive line, that you can prepare things and then when the enemy attacks you, you're going to do much better. So what these generals are asking for continuously is they're asking to pull men out of the front line and to form reserves. So they will obviously pick and choose where they can pull men out of the front line where it won't collapse at this point in time. They'll form reserves, they'll build defensive lines, and they'll prepare. And there are two things here. The one is to have reserves. You pull men out of the front lines, you form them into groups, you train them, you prepare them, and then you use them as a fire brigade. You rush them to places where troops are under stress. That's the first thing. And then the next thing is, if you find that the enemy is breaking through your lines, that they are busting through your lines and they're starting to break you up, that what you then do is you fall back to defensive positions that you've prepared. You go into pre-prepared trenches, bunkers, etc., and you fight them at your next position. And they also, the enemy needs to then advance. They need to expend fuel and time to advance to get to your next position. You're already there. You've prepared it. You toss your troops in there. You're ready to go. You're ready to fight them again. And you always have a fallback position. That's your next fallback position. And that is the way that these German generals are trying to do this. What they want is they want lines that they can retreat to that are in a better state, that are, in the case of the original one around Moscow, that are warmer, prepared, set up, etc. Then you just retreat and you fight the enemy there. Because what you're trying to do is you are trying to stop your troops from being overloaded. In the case of the Moscow thing, you are trying to stop your troops from dying in the cold. And yes, as de Grel says, you will lose your heavy weapons. But now you get to an interesting point. And the question is, what is the most valuable thing that you have? And this is really the crux of the argument between Hitler and Manstein and Guderian, is that Manstein and Guderian and the generals are telling Hitler that the most important thing that you have are your soldiers. Your soldiers, the physical men that you have, are the most important things. Hitler makes arguments that the territory is the most important thing. Yes, over long periods of time, he's right. If you measure it over decades and centuries, yes, territory is the most valuable thing. But when you are measuring it in a time period of hours, days, weeks, then men are the most important thing. Leon de Grel raised the issue that if you retreat, you lose your heavy weapons. But again, which is the most important thing? Is it the weapon, the man, or the territory? And I will tell you that generals, who are the men who organize armies and fight wars, they know that the most important thing they have are the men. The soldiers, the common soldier, is the most important thing of all. He is your most valuable asset. If you have to choose between losing a weapon and losing a soldier, you will see that much of the time you would rather lose the weapon than the soldier. There are certain kinds of weapons where you now start losing the men. I'm not saying that the men must always live. Like in the case of a ship or a tank, you can't now take a ship and retreat because you're going to lose one guy. That's crazy. So there are points at which you do lose men. You can't have a tank retreating just because one guy might die. You do take real risks. You do take actual risks where men can die. So it's not like you're not going to take any risks at all. But to sacrifice huge numbers of men just for territory or just for weapons, that can be the real loss that you have. And in the case of the Germans, I've looked at some of the stuff that's still coming out of the German industries in 1944. And even in 1945, you won't believe it, even in 1945, there's still weaponry that's coming out that's good, that can be used. Those Germans, even if they lose their heavy weapons, there are new weapons that are coming in, like Panzerfausts, which they use against tanks. The Panzerfausts are amazing. So the real issue is trying to keep the men alive. All that those generals are arguing for, going back to our chart, is change your tactics so that you lose less men. That's really what they're arguing about, is stop the hemorrhaging of the army. Those losses that we are seeing in 1944, even in 1943, that by playing your game differently, you can reduce, you can massively reduce the deaths of those men. And you need to preserve those men. I must tell you, in some of the stuff that I've read and looked at from the Germans in World War II, is that by 1943, I must tell you, there are German soldiers and pilots who are like supermen. I'm not joking with you. Not only are the German generals on the Eastern Front the finest generals that you can get, but there are lots of officers at all levels and soldiers, individual soldiers who are super soldiers, guys like Whitman and many others. There are aces in the air. There are aces in the tanks. These guys are super duper soldiers. But their problem is that they're being put into almost impossible situations. And men are getting killed needlessly. And that is the real crux of this thing, is that these generals are trying to save the lives of their troops. The generals don't want all their guys to die. Everybody knows that this is risky and that they must risk their lives. But they don't just want to let their guys die needlessly. Whereas Hitler is saying, the territory is more important. You must stand and fight. There are even times when Hitler orders men who've retreated successfully, he even orders them to go back to the places where they were overwhelmed. And if he sends them back, they're all going to get killed. So that is where the real difference comes between Hitler and the generals. And Hitler is making the argument that the land is more important than the men, and Hitler is wrong. He's wrong. Your soldiers, even if your soldiers have fled and lost their weapons, they are more valuable than anything else. You are losing your most valuable resource, your people. And even more importantly, you are losing experienced people. You are losing experienced commanders and troops are getting killed needlessly, who would be so valuable if they could just live and fight again in another situation. It is generals who have learned through centuries of warfare that when you are really pushed, that you've got to trade land for your men. You use land to buy space and time. You not only save the lives of your troops, but you are buying time. And in the case of the Germans, with those weapons of theirs that are coming online, that would have actually worked very well. When I look at this, I can't say how long Germany could have lasted. But I would say that Germany would have lasted a couple of years longer, hey? Germany could have lasted a couple of years longer. And if Hitler had put Manstein in charge, Germany could maybe have fought the enemy to a standstill. Manstein had many very interesting ideas, and I'm going to revisit some of them. There are solutions to problems that he had that are really amazing. The Germans could very likely have fought the whole world to a standstill. And the casualties that they would have inflicted on the Anglos, the Americans, the British, and the Canadians could have been incredible. One thing that I think Hitler did that was silly, that I don't think was good, was going after places for their propaganda value. Stalingrad was one such example. Hitler was very much into psychology, and he knew how humans think. And I think he overrated some of the psychology. And some places like Stalingrad, it wasn't worth it. It was not a proper military target. The real issue here between Hitler and the generals is that the generals are basing their thinking on long-standing military analysis, things that have lasted through the ages that are true. And Hitler is misreading this. He thinks that they are trying to stuff him up, but they are not. They are actually telling him the truth, and they are actually helping him. And the irony is that if Hitler just sat back more, Hitler had created a wonderful state. The state was functioning perfectly. If Hitler had just sat back more, put the right guys in charge in the right positions, like Manstein in charge of the Eastern Front, he could have sat back and focused his energy on the other areas like science and the economics, etc. And Germany would have done much better. Germany would have survived. It's possible that Germany could have fought them all to a standstill. That is possible. And they could have inflicted insane losses on their enemies. Really, the Anglos, the Americans and the British could have been badly, badly burned. So that's my analysis of Hitler versus his generals. But now, let's go back to Frederick the Great. Hitler had studied history. Hitler's hero is Frederick the Great. And Hitler understands many things about Frederick the Great. But there's something that Hitler didn't understand about Frederick the Great. And that's what I want to discuss with you. So, on that screen in front of you, we see Frederick the Great says, "Great things are achieved only when we take great risks." That is a white man of great genius, and he's telling you something very awesome. But risks and the art of risk-taking is another area that military commanders specialize in. Nobody on earth, no men on earth, no men or women on earth go into the art of risk-taking as much as the military guys do. This is their world. This is the world where they are comfortable. They do nothing but operate on the edge of the greatest danger and greatest risk. And Frederick the Great took awesome risks. Frederick the Great was on the edge of total wipeout so many times. Now, Frederick the Great's real war, which is known as the Seven Years' War, but which could in reality have been termed World War I, actually, because it was a huge war and it was Prussia against everybody else. There is one advantage Frederick the Great had, which Hitler did not have, and that is, can you believe, the British funded Frederick the Great. The British were the economic power behind Frederick the Great. And so Frederick the Great ended up fighting France, he ended up fighting the Austrians and even the Russians with his tiny little country, Prussia. Frederick the Great should really have lost his war, but he survived and he won simply by hanging in there and refusing to quit. And then eventually something happened. Somebody died, and his enemies actually kind of grew tired of fighting him and they let him go. That is how he won. He won simply by outlasting his enemies, but he faced impossible situations. And here's how Frederick the Great did it in a nutshell. That quote of Frederick the Great on the top right, "He who defends everything defends nothing." He who defends everything defends nothing. Clearly, Hitler was not aware of that quote. Somewhere in Hitler's readings, he missed out on this thing, because Frederick the Great was a total believer in this. It's one of those really pithy European things where a man says something in one sentence, and that sentence contains a huge truth. He who defends everything defends nothing. What the hell is Frederick the Great saying there? Well, in this case, Hitler totally violates this thing that Frederick says. Hitler is trying continuously to defend everything. In fact, we whites in Africa, we violated that very thing. Rhodesia violated this thing. We Rhodesians violated this thing so much. South Africans violated this thing so much. We kept trying to defend every inch of what we had. And militarily, it's stupid. I did a whole video about Rhodesia and how Rhodesia could have survived, and it is based on exactly this same thing, that if you try to defend everything, you're going to lose. I did an entire video about Rhodesia where I pointed out, could we have survived if we had traded land for time and we used retreat as a method of fighting? Well, that's exactly what Frederick the Great did. What Frederick the Great did was he had his army, he gathered everything together into his military force, he was in charge of it, and he was very selective where he went with his army and what he defended. And there were places where he just let things go. He did not defend everything. In fact, he was so true to that rule that, can you believe, at a point, the Russians invaded Prussia and actually went into his capital, which was Berlin. The Russians came and they captured the capital, Berlin, and they sacked it. They damaged it, but Frederick the Great did not fight them there. Berlin was his, but he didn't fight them there. He instead focused his army on where the greatest threats were and who he really needed to deal with. So he even let other armies come and tear into parts of his country, even his capital, and he just took the losses, man. But the one thing Frederick preserved at all times was his army. He preserved his army at all times. And he used and maneuvered his army with aggressiveness and determination. In his 7 years' war, he only fought 16 battles. That's about two battles a year. He fought 16 big battles in those 7 years of war. And of the 16 battles, he lost half of them. He was fighting with everything he had, And even when he used everything he had, he didn't always win. But he preserved his troops. And even when he lost his battles, his enemies were shit scared of him. He could lose a battle and his army would still be so kick-ass that his enemies would not attack him even after he'd lost a battle. Even after he'd lost a battle, he would aggressively make aggressive maneuvers with his army, and his enemies would be very scared of him. Frederick the Great is the greatest example of how to preserve your army and keep your army going, and Frederick the Great is the proof that your army and your men are more important than your territory. Now you could argue that, well, maybe technology was not so advanced in his day, maybe he was not losing that much. Yes, you could maybe make part of that argument, but I definitely think that most of what Frederick the Great says is true. And the key thing is that Frederick was careful as to where he focused his energy. He was very careful that he did not waste his troops and waste their lives on things that weren't necessary. In fact, he often was fighting the Austrian Empire. So here was Frederick with his little army in his little country, and he was facing off against three huge empires, and he had to balance between all three of them with his one little army. And he lived by that motto, he who defends everything defends nothing. But in reality, what he's preserving are his troops. He's preserving his troops. He is only fighting the battles that are necessary. And otherwise, he's using what is known in military terms as maneuver. He's using maneuver. He's moving his troops forwards, backwards, this way, that way. In other words, he's doing exactly what Manstein and Guderian and the other generals want to do, is they want to use maneuver. They want to use time and space and maneuver as the way of preserving their troops so that they can ultimately sort out things and smash them again, so that when they lose, they don't really lose much. In the same way that Frederick the Great could lose half of his battles and yet manage to hang in and survive until his enemies grew tired of him. The German generals were trying to do that, and it's valid, and it's totally valid. The question is, did Hitler ever perhaps have second thoughts about what his generals were saying? Well, you'll see that right at the end of 1944, Hitler has fired Manstein, he's changed things, he's been firing lots of other generals. And right at the end of 1944, Hitler does a strange thing. Suddenly, out of nowhere, Hitler takes his last forces and he forms an army and he launches an attack against the Americans. A surprise attack against the Americans, and it's known as the Battle of the Bulge. And the Battle of the Bulge causes the Americans the greatest losses that they experience of World War II. So after Hitler has gone all this time telling them to never retreat, finally Hitler himself orders what became known as the Battle of the Bulge. And sadly, in the Battle of the Bulge, they lost excellent troops and they lost excellent equipment. So the Battle of the Bulge, just like Kursk, are two battles that if Hitler had not fought those battles, and Hitler had rather just preserved the troops, preserved the machines, he would have been in a better situation. He did not have to attack. We will discuss attack versus defense in more detail in other videos, in other military videos, but war is about motion, and war is very dynamic, but it's an art. War is an art. It's like playing a game of chess, and it's got even more aspects than chess. It's got far more aspects than chess. Hitler's hero was Frederick the Great, and Hitler wanted to be of that same caliber. And there is no question that in non-military things, Hitler was achieving great and awesome things. And even Hitler's general insights into military strategy and into various ideas, most of the time, Hitler is good and Hitler's right. But Hitler made that one mistake. That mistake about fighting to the last man, last round, and denying his military officers the chance to retreat, and forcing his men even to fight when they are overloaded, when they will die shortly. They are overloaded, they're not going to be able to last long, and they're going to die. He's overdone it. In Hitler's case, it's simply a case of overdoing it, and he's missed out on perhaps the most critical lesson that could have come from Frederick the Great. Maybe somewhere, somehow, I don't know how it was that he missed it, but he missed that one lesson. And if he had been aware of that lesson, he who defends everything defends nothing, and he'd just trusted his best generals, Germany might not have had those losses in the end. And the real story of World War II could well have been the story that Germany may have survived. That Germany could have fought everybody. And the opposite side of that chart is that if those troops are surviving, and they are not losing that many men, and the Germans buy time for themselves, and the Germans invent new weapons, even though the Germans are losing territory. The fact is, the Germans would be able to inflict more and more losses on their enemies. And I can tell you that it is very lucky for the Americans and the British that they came out with as few losses as they did in World War II. Because if they'd had to face the kind of fight back that the German army gave the Soviets, then the death toll in Britain and America would have been seriously much higher, much, much higher. The Soviets themselves say that they lost 8 million killed. And I think 18 million injured, something like that. And if they'd fought, if they'd left guys like Manstein to do their thing, Manstein and Guderian and Raus to do their thing, I'm telling you, the Germans had enough talent that they could have killed a couple of million more Soviets. And the death toll of the Americans and the British would have gone through the roof if Germany had survived even another 2 years. Their losses would have gone through the roof. The Germans were not as close to being finished as you would think. It is Hitler's firing of his generals and Hitler's forcing his men to fight when they are vastly overloaded and they are dying needlessly. That is the thing that shortens World War II. And military officers who've studied World War II, they know this. This is true. If Hitler had just left his generals alone, his best guys were not going to overthrow him. Never at any time did Guderian or von Manstein or Raus or any of the other guys, never at any time did they take part in any of the plots to kill Hitler. They were not like that at all. They were loyal to Germany. So this does not diminish Hitler. It's just that this is what bit Hitler the most at the end. And the irony is that he had created such an awesome state that was functioning by itself that he did not need to get involved in the nitty-gritty of what the generals do. If he left his best generals alone to do their own thinking and to make their recommendations to him, he would have done better. He could have been much more relaxed and Germany would have lasted much longer and they would have hurt their enemies much more, which is what Hitler wanted. Hitler didn't want to just give in. So it's kind of ironic that his interference shortened Germany's time. That's the real sad thing about this. And Manstein himself wrote deeply about the fact that warfare is like having a sword fight, that there are times when you move backwards and there are times when you plunge forwards with your sword and you get into the thing. Motion. War is about motion. There are times for motion and there are times when you can build lines. These are things we'll get more into later. Even if we took those charts, even if we took 1943, for example, and extrapolated that forward, the Germans would probably have easily lasted into 1946. Easily. In fact, I really think that if Hitler had done at the end what he did in the beginning, all Hitler had to do was to take guys who were proven, like Guderian, von Manstein, Raus, and others, and bring those geniuses together and say to them, listen, you guys came up with a plan for France, 1940. Come back to me with a plan for Russia, Eastern Front. You guys know what's going on. Come, tell me, what must we do? You come up with a plan, you tell me the plan. And I will bet you that the Germans would have slaughtered Russians and caused them losses like you cannot believe. And what I'm trying to make clear in this video is that you must not look at Germany as just stupid and collapsing. That in actual fact, German industry, German science, the German army, it was still in great shape. Even after 4 years of war, it was still in great shape, and they had tremendous experience, tremendous skill. They could have fought on insanely. Manstein was of the opinion that Germany could have fought the Russians to a standstill, and then all that was needed was to find a way to fight the Allies to a standstill. I will return to that topic because the whole Allied invasion and D-Day, can you believe there was a counter-strategy that you've never heard of? And it's the best. It's absolutely amazing. It's a topic I will return to later. But this fighting on the Eastern Front, this is where 90% of the war is taking place, and things could have turned out differently. The Germans, with their militarization, they were rocking. They were rocking. They could have become and continued to be like the French, like the Romans, like Frederick the Great. They could easily have won. They could have come close to winning. or even just fought the enemy to a standstill so that the enemy eventually tires out. That's all they needed. And it was within their capability. And it was there within the skill and the ability of those men. Keep in mind, history is the key to the present, is the key to the future. Don't let Jews fool you with their bullshit. Nothing has changed. The world is still the same it's always been. It's just Jews that are trying to fool you into thinking it isn't.
So for all this awesome, neat, wonderful stuff, you know, you don't thank the Lord, you thank the whites. We gave you Breaking Bad and all the songs by Creed, all the cast of Friends and trash like Tara Reid, a virtual world of porn so you can spill your seed. Ray-Ban glasses, leggy blondes with tiny asses, frisbee sports and fancy coffee too, energy efficient lights. And so for all this awesome, neat, wonderful stuff, you know you don't thank the Lord, you thank the whites.
Thank the whites, thank the whites.